strike in Chicago continues, the contest isn't just between the teachers' union and the Chicago Board of Education. Many see the Chicago conflict as a battle for the future, not just of unions, but of public education. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports a lot of groups have a stake in the way things turn out.
Teachers' unions from around the country have been paying close attention to what's going on here in Chicago. The Chicago Teachers' Union held a rally this weekend where supporters came from far and near. Mainly near.
Meetings of solidarity from Wisconsin.
Bob Peterson is president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. He drew parallels between the union fight in Wisconsin against that state's Republican Governor Scott Walker and the Chicago fight against Democratic Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
Walker and Emanuel are two sides of the same pro-corporate, pro-privatization agenda.
Union leaders such as Peterson have offered their moral support to the teacher strike. When you talk to teachers, often the main sticking point isn't any individual provision of the contract. It's an overall distrust of the Chicago School Board and a fear of where unions are headed as a whole. Lisa Wyatt teaches at Hyde Park Academy on Chicago's South Side.
I understand the fiscal problems in our economy, but there has to be a stand taken by the community against an agenda to privatize education.
Wyatt says she doesn't trust the Board of Education will live up to the promises, mainly that they will provide resources to teachers in local schools. That's why she says teachers have been hesitant about signing on to the contract. Then Wyatt repeats what's become a mantra in this school strike.
We're fighting for the soul of public education. We are fighting for the soul. What is happening here in Chicago has been happening all over the country.
Like most fights nowadays, this one is being played out on the airwaves.
Teachers are on strike, and kids are the losers. A deal is within reach. All CTU has to do is grab it.
Democrats for Education Reform is a group that's bankrolling ads that have been played on radio and television opposing the strike. It's just one of many groups of a variety of political stripes that is participating in the Chicago strike.
Well, the strike really is the quintessence. It's the convergence of all these efforts, pro and con. School reform, charters, teachers, here we are. I guess you would call it a perfect storm.
Barbara Radner teaches urban education at DePaul University.
Some groups are interested out of the fact that they see this as perhaps the teacher union's last stand. Some groups are involved because they resist charters. But this is Chicago. If we had a unified city, we probably wouldn't be having a strike.
Radner says Chicago will be a battleground for education reform long after this strike is over. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Chicago.
And again, Chicago Teachers Union members will meet to discuss the possibility of ending their strike today at 3 p.m. Students from University Laboratory High School in Urbana, in partnership with WILL, have prepared a week-long series of reports on 60s counterculture. In today's segment, we look at student protests to the Vietnam War on the campus of the University of Illinois. Today's report is produced by Uni High student Nafia Syed and is voiced by Linus Urbach.
Despite generally peaceful intentions, some University of Illinois students became violent as they protested the Vietnam War. They believed that they needed to use any means necessary to stop the war, and they felt that the end would justify the means. Debbie Cox, a student at the time, remembers the passionate actions of some protesters in Champaign-Urbana, as well as the retaliations of policemen.
So they felt they could throw rocks at Follett's bookstore with impunity, or, you know, trash the businesses on Green Street during some protests. But I also saw how polarization going on in our society would affect our protest lines. It wasn't long before they became quite uncivil. A protester would hurl an insult at a policeman, and the policeman, most policemen really didn't have a lot of training in how to deal with student dissenters. And so they would be quick-tempered, too, and they'd start shouting things about how, you know, their son was in Vietnam and they didn't want to hear any more crap, you know, students who didn't know anything. It, it's quick to escalate.
Victor Fine, another former University of Illinois student, also saw escalating tension between police and students during protests.
You know, I started out marching with totally peace on my heart. And as time went on and there were police and National Guard lining the streets, there were thousands of kids marching. The emotions were very high. There was screaming and yelling at the National Guard, even though they didn't do anything wrong. They were just there.
Renee Pollock, a University of Illinois student during the protests, remembers how she felt about the violence.
Well, sometimes it was scary. I was kind of an intellectual kid and a nonviolent kid. So sometimes when I would be in this group of people, like I looked around and I would wonder, are you people just people who have always wanted to throw a rock, so you're just doing it? Or do you have a real idea behind what you're doing?
For some protesters, throwing rocks was an expression of their true commitment to the cause. For others, it was a result of getting caught up and resulted in a betrayal of their values of peace and harmony.
Tin soldiers and Nixon's coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming, for dead in Ohio, for dead in Ohio, for dead in Ohio, for dead in Ohio.
We heard University Laboratory High School sophomore Linus Urbach speaking on behalf of student reporter Nafi Sissied. Listen to the Uni High and Illinois Public Media documentary Beyond the Tie-Dye, Counterculture in Champaign-Urbana, 1965-75, this Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on WILL AM 580. Google's plan to create the world's largest digital library ran into legal problems when groups of authors sued to defend the rights to their work. The lawsuit, now in its 11th year, has run into yet another legal delay. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
When Google set out to scan the world's books, it was ostensibly for high-minded reasons. In an interview a few years ago, co-founder Sergey Brin told me it was part of Google's grand mission to make all the world's information searchable. He didn't want to wait because books can be lost at any moment.
And there are floods and there are fires. And of course, you know, the most famous example of all, the Library at Alexandria,
which burnt to the ground in ancient times. Hopefully this lawsuit will be resolved before the internet is ancient. Since 2004, Google has been fighting with the Authors Guild. The guild claims the company can't scan books without getting permission from the author. Yesterday, a judge put the case on hold while Google appeals the right of the Authors Guild to bring a class action. UC Berkeley law professor Pam Samuelson says Google is confident enough to keep scanning.
But the sense that I have from talking to people is that maybe they have slowed down a little bit.
But that may also be because Google has reportedly already scanned some 20 million books, now safe from fires, even if the public can't access them. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
It's a New York City cliche. Sidewalk vendors selling handbags, hats, umbrellas, you name it. Where are they from?
I'm from Senegal.
Senegal.
Originally, I'm from Senegal.
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 Why the Senegalese sell goods on the sidewalks and what they know about the weather. Later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. 10,000 Villages is celebrating 26 years of trading fairly in Champaign-Urbana, offering eco-friendly handcrafted decor and gift items from around the world. A gift from 10,000 Villages is a gift that gives twice.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, September the 18th, 2012. It's the birthday of Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, born Litchfield, England, 1709, sickly child, but very intelligent, and when he decided to get married at the age of 25, he set out in search of an intelligent wife. He found one in a woman who was 21 years older than he, a widow. She had three children. Elizabeth Porter Jervis was her name. He called her Teddy. And when she met Johnson, she said to her daughter, "That is the most sensible man I ever met." Samuel Johnson, who said, "Marriage has many pains, but celibacy has no pleasures." It was on this date, 1793, George Washington put on his ceremonial Masonic sash and apron and laid the cornerstone for the Capitol building in Washington. Tiffany and Company was founded in New York City on this date, 1837, stationery and fancy goods emporium. Abraham Lincoln bought jewelry for his wife at Tiffany's. And Truman Capote made it famous with his novella Breakfast at Tiffany's. Holly-Golightly, his heroine, takes a cab down to Tiffany's whenever she's feeling low. She says, "It calms me down right away, the quietness and the proud look of it. Nothing very bad could happen to you there, not with those kind men in their nice suits and that lovely smell of silver and alligator wallets." It's the birthday of the actress and playwright Anna Deavere Smith, born Baltimore, 1950, known for her one-woman shows in which she chooses a contemporary event, does extensive interviews with people involved, and then turns them into characters. She did one about the Rodney King beating in Los Angeles, another about the Crown Heights riots in Brooklyn. It's the birthday of Greta Garbo, born Greta Gustafsson in Stockholm, 1905. Grew up poor. She was shy. Her father died when she was 15. She had to go to work to help support the family. She became a department store model, went to study at the Royal Dramatic Theater, and caught the eye of a movie director, Moritz Stiller. He took her under his wing, changed her last name to Garbo, cast her in a movie. And when he signed a deal with MGM in Hollywood, he insisted on bringing her along. She became a big star with the movie Flesh and the Devil, 1926, a movie at which she met and fell for her co-star John Gilbert. They went on to star in a silent film adaptation of Anna Karenina and several more features. They got engaged. Garbo called off the wedding at the last minute, and she never married. She traveled. She had many close friends. She loved New York City, though she did guard her privacy. People quoted the line that she spoke in the movie Grand Hotel, but they misquoted it, and Garbo once pointed out, "I never said, 'I want to be alone.' I only said, 'I want to be let alone.' There is all the difference." Here's a poem for today by Faith